This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse contains the question and answer session from the June 21, 2005 discussion group on chapters 2 and 9 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. John's commentary is available in Part 1. The LA Sound Posse records and publishes anti-copyrighted talks and events such as this and can be reached at lasoundposse.org. The contact information will be repeated at the end of the recording.
Let's see, next month we are doing on our outline chapter 6 in Zinn, The Intimately Oppressed, on women, the history of women in the U.S.
Just six.
So let's have questions, comments. And would you just reintroduce your first name so that we can keep names and faces together? And we've got about, what, another hour? What time is it? Anybody got the time? Okay. Okay, we've got about an hour. So questions, comments, arguments?
My name is Teresa. As I was listening to how many different societies engaged in slavery and racism throughout history, the question to me is not who has participated in it, but who hasn't, if any culture. You know, we know that it's not just black and white. It's the North Koreans don't like the South Koreans. The Chinese don't like the Japanese. The British don't like the Irish. And it's just, is there any society that has ever existed that didn't have that sort of thing? Any tribes in Africa or anywhere? It's a question.
Well, in terms of, and other people can help me in terms of the knowledge of anthropology, but just in looking at Zinn's chapter, we don't have an exhaustive list. For example, formal chattel slavery, the ownership, as far as I know, in more recent history, of course, I mean, the North Koreans or the South Koreans haven't owned each other. We're talking about an ownership master-slave relationship. We know from Zinn's chapter that the so-called savages that Columbus encountered, the Taino, did not hold slaves. As far as I know, the member nations of the Iroquois Confederacy did not hold slaves. So there are examples. It's not a universal aspect of human history. We're talking about a very specific, not talking about just oppressing people. I mean, for example, I'm reading now some Greek and Roman history, and the Greeks and the Romans took slaves, conquered people, and took slaves. But we're talking about a very specific form of slavery, which Du Bois, Eric Williams, and other scholars argue was very unique to the American or U.S. form of slavery, and their argument is that particular kind of historical slavery really began with the Columbus, in which he took some of the natives from those islands, not just as conquered, and then it becomes an actual financial situation when slaves become commodified. So if there are people here who've done more research in anthropology, please jump in.
You're right, it's something that's never been done in any other form. A lot of people got involved with it, like the Cherokee. Some of the Cherokee fought on the south side, and some of the Cherokee fought on the north side. Some of them were pro-slavery, some of them were anti-slavery, and they had fallen into that whole thing. You brought up the question of the North Koreans and South Koreans. Well, that was an arbitrary line that was set down by the United States, just like North Vietnam and South Vietnam. There's no such thing as North Koreans and South Koreans. They're all Koreans. that kind of hatred the Japanese had towards the Koreans is more of an example, but it was never, and it was formulated as a slavery type of thing too, but it still was different than capitalist slavery, is what you can call it, I guess. That was formulated particularly by the United States. It was done a little bit in Europe, but it didn't last in Europe very long. The English did it for a little while, but then the English outlawed it. But it's something that's pretty unique to what we have. One point I wanted to make too was about the clan type organizations. I remember years ago the posses became fashionable, and I remember books being put out that was drawing the attentions that the people that were running the posses were leaders of the Klan and the Nazis and things of that nature. And today we have the Minutemen, who, well, I haven't seen the evidence yet, but I can swear that it's got that same leadership passed down to it and being directed towards other peoples. One other thing that's very important in the news these days, and that's destruction of any kind of alliance between the Mexican and other Latin American peoples and African Americans. I remember back in the 60s even that one of the things that the state was really trying to eliminate was any kind of coalition between those peoples as being two of the largest, most oppressed peoples in the United States.
Just a brief comment that in addition to the issue of slavery, of course, in these chapters, he's talking about the systematic development of racism in the United States, essentially directed, though not totally directed, just at people of African descent, in which it becomes institutionalized, as I indicated, in every single aspect of American life. It is legalized, it is upheld by the state courts, it is upheld by the federal courts, it is upheld by the Supreme Court. It's come down to us decade after decade, and the progressive changes that happen, because this is not 1930s Mississippi. There would be no trial of anyone in Mississippi if it were 1930s for killing a black man and two white men who were supporting him, which of course has been fictionalized. A number of you, I'm sure, have seen Mississippi Burning, a very historically distorted film that makes out the FBI to be heroes. Well, if you read the actual history of what happened in the South under J. Edgar Hoover, that is not what the FBI was doing in the South. In some ways, they were working hand in hand with the Klan. But those changes have happened so that things are different in this country as opposed to 40 years ago because of what people did and because of, tragically, the deaths of those three young men and others. That history is being erased, by the way, or revised to make it appear that those who then opposed any movement for justice for black people somehow supported it. And that's why we need to go back and really look at the documents.
My name is Hartley. I was going to raise something. I'm going to get to the crux of it. This is an issue that I've tried to figure out a long time, what I'm saying to you. I don't understand it. I mean, John has done an excellent job here of describing what happened. But what I don't understand, I never really have been able to understand, is why it happened. I mean, we've had virulent hatred of African Americans for 400 years. I mean, you talk about it in terms of, well, there was an economic aspect to it for slavery, they made money, profits, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you know, there's different reasons. But for it to last so long, and it appears to me to still be very prevalent among everybody. I was a teacher for 30 years, and I was a union rep for 20 of those 30 years, and I had the most liberal teachers around me through most of my working career. And they were very liberal people, and they believed in everything that you people probably believe in. And they were racist. And it came out subtly in their humor and their attitude, their comments about just things in the news. I'll tell you one small story. I was traveling on a train in Europe once, and I was a young man. I was in my 20s, and there was a guy there who was also in his 20s, a German. And we started talking, and I somehow moved the conversation around to what happened to the Jews. And he kind of intimated that was his parents' generation, his generation didn't feel responsibility, that kind of thing. And I got a little miffed at that and kind of intimated that maybe he should accept some of the responsibility. And he stopped cold and he looked at me and he said, "You Americans are something else." He said, "Well, whenever I ask an American such as yourself about slavery and about lynchings, for example, you always say, well, that happened in the South. And I'm a Northerner, I'm a Westerner, I'm not a part of that. But when Germans say, well, that was my parents' generation, or that was the Nazis, you won't let us off the hook. You tell us that everybody in Germany is responsible. Well, if everybody in Germany is responsible for what happened to the Jews, then everybody in the United States is responsible for what happened to African Americans in this country. And that makes me responsible for lynchings. I mean, it's really hard for me to get my head around that, but that's what it means. And I've, you know, this conversation with this young man happened 30 years ago. I just don't understand,
you don't understand
this country where I live.
I mean, that is, you don't have any theoretical explanation for why this unfolded in this society?
Yeah, I used to teach history. I have a theoretical explanation, I need to go beyond that. I don't have the psychological explanation. I don't see how such a hatred could be so strong in contemporary society or in the society that I grew up in over the last 50 years.
Well, Du Bois would argue, for example, is that often psychology follows other things, one of them being the dollar sign, that psychology follows sociology and history. And we think of chattel slavery, think of the beginning of the slave trade in the Western world. Europe, the United States, the Caribbean, to South America. No, but I'm saying is that in terms of trying to get to the roots of issues, I mean, there are contemporary manifestations of this. There are slave-like conditions which still exist in the United States, but official, documented, legalized chattel slavery ended in the United States with the Civil War. Now, Du Bois and others would argue that there are tangible reasons. There's not some irrational hatred that white people are born with that they want to enslave black people, right? Otherwise, it would be hard to explain why the British essentially enslaved the Irish, why Western Europeans enslaved the Slavs, that there are tangible things that people get. And the psyche, in a sense, is connected to that. Ideologies develop to rationalize it. Preachers come out of the woodwork, especially in the South, telling people, including blacks, every Sunday that God designed this world. This has happened. It's found in the book of Genesis, and it's this, and it's Cain and Abel, etc. I mean, the libraries are filled with actually some very fine historical works to give us a handle on where this came from. And that's part of what Zinn is trying to get at, that it's not some...
Why is it still here?
Well, it's still here because it benefits. I mean, this is the issue of power. It benefits people. It is not some irrational... I mean, think of Mississippi. Think of 40 years ago in Mississippi, the Klan, the sheriffs. I'm sure all of you remember 40 years ago, those shots of Sheriff Rainey and those other cracker sheriffs sitting around chewing tobacco. I still have, you know, this image. Maybe that's the stereotype locked in my head. But they're sitting around laughing in their hearing, okay? Their power, and in a sense, many times they were the goons for people with greater power. Their power, the power of the planters, the power of the corporations in Mississippi, those things get undermined if black people get power, get economic and political power. So they're real manifestations of why that it's not irrational. They get power. Goodman and Cheney and Schwerney organize people, and Stokely Carmichael and Fannie Lou Hamer and Malcolm, etc. They organize people in Mississippi and elsewhere. The power shifts in the country. That means the people, you know, and it's not a win-win game, by the way. Okay? It's not a win-win game. It's a conflict. It's a fundamental conflict. The folks in Mississippi running that state for decades, they lose power to black people. They have to lose power in order for black people to gain it. That's what happens. And they're going to develop a whole psychological makeup and they're going to teach in their schools, and they still do, about these kinds of things. And that's rooted, and then we grow in our families to hate, to have this bitter hatred. But it's institutionalized. The attitudes of hate, the overt manifestations of hate, have subsided in U.S. society. But other aspects, for example, black unemployment vis-a-vis white unemployment is worse today than 40 years ago. Black infant mortality. That's what Du Bois and others mean by institutionalized racism. It's not that, you know, a group of doctors want black kids to die more than white kids, or anybody wills this, but if you just take resources out of some communities, and of course, thinking of the South again, most of the poorest counties in the United States are not in urban areas in the North, they're in the South, and they're in American Indian or Native American reservations. That's where the poverty is. So, forgive me for carrying on.
In response to the question, where has slavery not happened, I read a book called Slavery and Social Death. I've forgotten the name of the author, but he was, I think he was a professor at Harvard, and so it was a fairly well-researched thing that he did. And his finding was that no major civilization that he had come across had achieved its greatness without slavery. And I'll try and remember to bring the book in for show and tell next time.
So Rome, Greece, the British Empire, France, the U.S., etc. All right.
Hello, I'm Bob. John, you mentioned earlier that Ronald Reagan began his 1980 campaign in Philadelphia. Was there any official Philadelphia, Mississippi, right? And was there any official context given for him being there? What was the Republican line on that? Do you recall? Because I don't remember hearing anything about it, truthfully.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall the context other than Reagan, in a sense, following sort of the political shift that actually began with Goldwater in 64. As you recall, Lyndon Johnson won overwhelmingly. Goldwater won a few states in the South. And a number of people have argued that that was the beginning of the clear message to whites, especially in the South, to desert the Democratic Party and move to the Republican Party that would be much more aggressive and militant in defending white privilege. I don't know who his campaign manager was at that time. It wasn't Karl Rove, by the way. But it reminds me of the kind of thing that Karl Rove would be. Because Reagan, of course, could have started his campaign in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at the site of the Liberty Bell, but not in a majority black city at that time. That's 25 years ago. But I think it was a message. You know, they talked a lot about states' rights. I remember, because there have been some articles. He talked a lot about states' rights. And when you talk about states' rights south of the Mason-Dixon line in the 1960s and beyond, you don't have to have a sign that said, or a Dixie flag, you know, or with those Confederate stickers on those big trucks of guys with guns who don't just live in Mississippi. So people got the word. People got the word. And they understood what Reagan was saying about the South and racism.
I'm probably going to throw a monkey wrench into the whole discussion, but when this gentleman over here asked about the psychology of people with their racist attitudes, and the group in America which is most hated is not blacks but gays, particularly gay males. There have been some studies done in which people around the country were asked to rate their feelings of like or dislike for other groups, and gays came out considerably below blacks even, which makes me think that a lot of our problems with racism are fears of people who are different. That's a lot of think that that's behind the discrimination against, or more prejudice against, blacks and gays and other target groups. Also, in times of economic crisis, there's much more prejudice against immigrants. So I think a lot of these anti-feelings of prejudice toward out-groups is related psychologically to our fears of people who are different.
Carol, where do you think these fears come from? How do we explain, because there's generally a fear, but would you argue that the founding fathers, Jefferson, Madison, etc., the people who had power, are they afraid of people who are different? Or is it the common folks, the middling classes? I mean, where does this all come from?
I think it is true that lower classes and middle classes probably tend to be more fearful of the power. People in power have less to fear from others. And I think the founding fathers probably did not have this fear. But certainly the southern plantation owners did, although that fear again was of the classes getting together and opposing them. But I'm losing my trend of thought, and then your question, were they as afraid, I guess? No, I don't think people in power have as much to fear. They're not afraid generally economically, unless there's a third party, say, that's threatening to throw out both the major parties and rise above the other major parties in the country, then I think they would feel a lot of fear.
My name is Corrine. I wondered if you could comment on the recent story in the news about a heart drug being approved only for African Americans and how that fits into our discussion today.
I've seen, other than the very brief discussion, there was an article in the LA Times, there was an article in the New York Times about this drug. There was something I came across, brief discussion on the internet, I'm not sure what site because I get so many, on one hand asking people to, raising the question of why this is emerging at this time, that diseases among various groups in this society that some may claim to be sort of hardwired or genetically caused are deeply rooted in social and historical conditions, as a number of physicians, not just African-American physicians, have argued. But I haven't seen much more on it. Maybe someone else has seen a much more extended discussion, because we do have the demographic data that under similar circumstances with similar diseases, blacks are more likely to die, less likely to get to emergency rooms, less likely to get certain care. So, because they've done very careful studies. And again, you ask yourself, well, what's the fundamental variable here? And the same way with infant mortality, though infant mortality, of course, also is shaped hierarchically within races by income. It tends far more likely to be among mothers, children who are poor, of course. So it'd be interesting to see how this plays out, and I don't know. But I can't imagine that any kind of thing that involves groups of people in this society, medical or otherwise, is not in some way connected to the kind of issues we're talking about.
My name is Mary. I'd like to talk about the ideological uses of racism in addressing the question that the gentleman raised about psychology of racism and in other connections. First of all, I think that any kind of negative sentiment that's been institutionalized towards group, which we'll call racism in this case, but someone raised the issue of gays, which is a slightly different question, but so I'd like to stay with the issue of racism for now, is a tool to divide and a tool for obfuscation the real issues facing a capitalist society. And the racism towards blacks has been institutionalized to right now because blacks are marginalized to right now. And as a group, they have a subversive potential because they explode the myths that the prevailing ideology promulgates, which are essentially social Darwinism. In other words, people who are more fit will succeed. When a whole group of people are marginalized, that explodes that myth. So there's something inherently subversive about any group that has been marginalized and continues to be. I'm going to leave it there for now.
Hi, I'm Barbara. I just have a hypothesis to put out there in this struggle with the question of where does our capacity to be so cruel and devaluing of other human beings. I think it starts way before the fears and the structural part of it and the political part of it. But in the economic part of it. And being a psychologist, my hypothesis is that I think we learn it at very young ages by the way we treat our children, by the way throughout centuries we've treated women and children, but children, as non-humans, without respect, as property. And I think at those early ages is the beginning seeds of being able to look at any other group or being or nature in the world, of being able to be cold and distant and devaluing. I think we learn it at young ages by being devalued ourselves.
But how does it, remember, we're talking a very specific phenomenon now, that is the categorization of an entire group of people on the basis of, let's say, for want of a better term, skin color, all right? That people can clearly see there are differences among people in the world, all right? There are diversity among the human race as there's diversity in the natural world. What is it about the development of children that is linked to this specific, because it seems to be you're talking about a generalized devaluing of children. We're sort of worthless as children. How do we end up, though, with a very specific kind of hatred? That is, I don't end up hating all groups, but I end up hating African Americans or Japanese Americans. I mean, they're different forms of racism, or Jews. I mean, because that kind of racism is linked in terms of African Americans and Jews. But so how does the psychology of childhood get shaped into a very specific form of virulent, and this is virulent, where we people in this society actually organized parties. They didn't just lynch people, they had parties, and there's a traveling show in the United States based on postcards. I think it's now in New York, James Allen or someone, where people would actually send cards of the event. You know, we were in Tuscaloosa, and we had this party, and you know, and they have photos of people being lynched. So it's, how does this specific phenomenon come from the generalized demeaning of childhood?
As an aside to that, I sang in a barbershop choir at one point, and they wanted us to sing this song called The Cakewalk, and it was about picnics and cakewalks. And I looked at them and I said, do you know what this song is singing about? And it was singing about lynchings. That's what the picnics and the cakewalk was about back then. And because I could not sing that song. To your question, again, it's a hypothesis struggling with this question of how we can be so cruel. I think part is geography, you know, having differences in whatever resources are available or aren't. But again, it stems from this early childhood ability or support of creating lines and boundaries and differences and seeing everything in categories of different and other rather than all and together and as a, you know, world team.
Hi, I'm Laura, and I think that you already answered his question in a way. You talk about struggle, and it's always the oppressed group that has to struggle to change anything. If the man you met in the train or any of the other people that you meet, your union friends, whatever, express certain views, as they feel a certain comfort level, they feel a certain support around them. And Ronald Reagan could start his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, because there was, you know, it's like pushing a big rock uphill, people just get tired of that pushing, and so the weight falls back down. And Ronald Reagan's weight, he had numbers and attitudes and years on his side that he could let the rock fall down. And it's not fair that it's the oppressed people that bear the burden of changing everybody else, but that's just how it is. I'm a regular human being. I'm very lazy. I'm very comfortable in my attitudes. I can go even further than you. Among liberal people, in the 70s, there was a group of people in the East Coast who were going to Cuba, and they were interviewing candidates, and a couple of my girlfriends, white girlfriends, went to interview, and they asked, one of the questions that were asked to them is, how can we make this group less racist? And they suggested, we'll have more black people come. And the people who were organizing it thought that was ridiculous. You know, that's not a good answer, that's not about race, it's about class, blah, blah, blah. It's just, it's always, you know, it's like, if you want to know the answer, don't ask a lot of other white people what the answer is. Look to the oppressed people to tell you what direction to take, what are the questions to ask, what are the problems. And it's very hard to do that because I'm very comfortable where I am. I don't want to have to change that much. And I've got a lot of support. I've got that big rock falling back down the hill that other people have to push up. And they're already behind the eight ball, I'm mixing my metaphors. But it's hard to do. It's hard to change attitudes when you're struggling to make ends meet and everything else. But that's the way it is.
In response to the whole psychology and such, for about the last year I've been working with homeless folks, and there is a disproportionate number of African Americans that are homeless than something like 50-60% of the homeless population are black. And there's stuff coming out from the universities about the psychology of this, that basically of a trauma that was created during the slave days that is passed on generation after generation that causes this kind of situation. The similarity, I would believe, would be the same thing of the white supremacy being passed on from generation to generation as a cultural, psychological conditioning that people grow up with in their particular training. It's perpetuated by the ruling groups because it is a way of keeping people from uniting. I mean, one of the things Zinn pointed out was the horror that the slave owners had when they would find whites and blacks cooperating, say, in a rebellion or any kind of resistance to the whole system. But it's something that the hatred and things of that nature is so ingrained in the culture and is so used by the culture, and it is passed on from generation to generation. This as a more submissive type of poverty level conditions that some people find themselves in is passed on from one generation to the next generation. And it deals both, you know, economically, which ingrains into the psychology of individuals. So you do have a situation such as you have among the homeless folks. And it's similar to the Vietnam post-stress syndrome. And it is something that lasts generation after generation. And it is used basically to keep people divided and to make this kind of conditioning continue on.
Just a brief comment. You're working in Venice, in Santa Monica. The LA Times and the Santa Monica paper ran the long stories on the recent count of the homeless in LA County, and that their figures were that blacks were certainly disproportionately represented among the homeless population, approximately 39% in LA County, and black African Americans represent 9% of the population, so more than four times their number. The passing on from generation to generation is done, though, in a very specific way, because we're talking about, again, a relationship of domination and subordination, never complete because the subordinates, the oppressed, have always resisted in history. The Irish in Africa, in Asia, in the Middle East, in the U.S., whatever, in virtually everything we can look at. But what I mean by specific is that, for example, in that period, in that short period of Reconstruction, the first time in the history of the United States in which African Americans actually had some political power in the southern United States, a period in history, by the way, that I would argue that if every one of us were to go back to our high schools and go to the textbooks that we learned about the carpetbaggers and the scallywags, and we learned about all the corruption, and blacks took power, and they had parties in the South Carolina legislature, and they didn't do anything, and they stole money, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Eric Foner and W.E.B. Du Bois, who are probably the two foremost historians in this country on Reconstruction, blow those myths to smithereens. When blacks had some power in the South, they did not replicate the domination against white people that white people had done to them. That was the first period in Southern history in which there was public education. That's the first period in which they opened the franchise to poor whites. That's the first time a whole bunch of reforms that emerge in the U.S. history in the South emerge in those areas in which blacks had some influence with some progressive whites, of course, who then were targeted as well in the South. And the whole counter-revolution against the Reconstruction period, which begins probably with the Compromise of 1877, the election, supposedly another stolen election. And a number of historians argue that this period post-1960s, especially beginning with Reagan, is a similar period. It can't be the same. I mean, you cannot have marauding KKKers running rampant in the southern United States as you had in the 1870s and 80s and 90s. That simply cannot happen. Not that it might never happen, but it can't happen in this period. And so those reforms, which made life better for working people and farmers in the South, were pushed by the group that was oppressed, that didn't pass on the hatred, because it is not hardwired. And we know that when we see young children, that, you know, unless people are willing to argue that racism, remember, it's a very specific phenomenon, that unless we're willing to argue that it is hardwired, a number of people argue that we, you know, like the song from South Pacific, we have to be taught to hate. You watch young children, they might struggle over a toy or something, but there's no conception when you watch little white and black kids, Asian American kids together at very young ages. There is no conception of racial supremacy or domination and subordination. There simply is not, that is not there. It has to be learned. So of course it goes back, and if it gets ingrained deeply in us, it becomes, it's like this, you know, the Star Trek shield. I mean, nothing can get inside of that. I know that I'm superior, you're not. You can't get inside no matter, and my God, you know, religion, we haven't touched on that. We talked about that with Columbus. You cannot understand racism in this society without understanding the whole development of religion, especially Christianity. That's an issue. That's, quote unquote, the white elephant in the room that a lot of people don't want to discuss.
And that's what I wanted to discuss.
Wow.
My name is Curtis. Man, a lot of great thought. This is totally incoherent, all these threads of thoughts going on in my mind here. But the Christianity thing, that's what I was thinking about. You asked the question, well, this edifice of racism that we had here, and South Africa, Christian, the Dutch, the whole, this tendency of peoples throughout history to dehumanize and devalue another group is not confined to whites. It's not confined to Christians. But it is interesting that it really seemed to have flowered under white Christianity. And maybe it's so interesting that you read in American South, the slaveholders, at no time were they ever thinking of themselves as crass, ungodlike people. They developed all these wonderful justifications and rationalizations why, of course, they were doing the Christian thing. It's interesting. I mean, there was this weird manipulation of mental denial and rationalization, but it was around the standard of Christianity that somehow the standard of Christianity, which brought with it a couple of interesting things. One, it brought apparently this idea of equality, this idea of brotherhood. And so for other reasons, for very, you know, power, economic reasons, they had to subvert what they knew maybe deep down inside was wrong. In response to that, they developed this incredibly arcane and intricate edifice, which got tighter and tighter and wounder just to keep people down. But it was in response to this notion that was lodged in our collective heads that, hey, you know, Christianity is the root of this culture. We really should not be doing this. And we basically know we shouldn't. But we really can't give up what we got. You know, we can't. And so it gets twisted, and this edifice goes bigger and bigger. But what's interesting to me is that not only was Christianity kind of used, maybe because it flowered more in white Christian culture, because they felt at heart guiltier. I mean, the sense of guilt maybe was more pronounced. This is just thinking out loud here. More pronounced in white Christians in America and South Africa than in other places where that sense of personal guilt wasn't so strong. And so the rationalization and the denial and the edifice that you have to build to maintain, to keep down that sense of personal guilt, wasn't so strong. But along with the personal guilt
which flowered in Christianity, was the good thing. Because, you know, throughout this whole United States, our whole struggle for individual rights, you had these two competing things. You had, in a sense, people wanting to withhold the status quo, the Constitution, which was a slave document. I mean, you know, it was basically, this is the power system. And you had this fluke, the Declaration of Independence, which Jefferson threw in there because it was the political correct thing of the day. This was the age of rationalism. This is how people talked, you know, Locke. They all wrote this thing, everyone is equal. And so it was like a throwaway line. I mean, it really was. It was a throwaway line, and yet it stuck because that also is rooted in Christianity. So it's so interesting that Christianity, maybe, is the cause of this really obscene racial edifice that we've constructed to oppress people, and at the same time, it's at the root of the one ideal which we have used and people in this country are continuing to use to liberate each other, which is the Declaration of Independence, that all people are created equal. And there are very strong roots in that in Christianity. So this weird, these twins.
Slaves, of course, used the Christian stories of rebellion and revolt as a way to challenge the Christian white masters.
Or the Hebrew stories as well.
Yeah, yeah, more, that's right. Much more of the, actually, of the Old Testament than the New, but still used them. And religion was a very powerful force in holding people together under incredibly adverse circumstances.
I'd like to argue that, or suggest, that even though the institution of slavery doesn't exist, the concept is kept alive through a mechanism which is called in postmodern literature exoticizing a group, or, as has been stated, dehumanizing a group. And as long as we are able to do that, then racism, of course, will exist. And I'd like to suggest also that I don't think it's really related to color. I think the archetype of the enslavement of Africans is the most powerful tool that is being used to enforce that concept. And the reason I say that is I'd just like to convey a little anecdote. I was in Brazil with a friend who is Muslim who has a dark skin. And we had to talk to the police, and he described her as branca, which is white. And she asked me, she said, how is it that I could be described as white, and whereas someone lighter than she was being described as mulatto or mixed? And I think that is how powerful that is, and it's not only in this country, it's in other countries, unfortunately, as well.
Yeah, these issues that we're talking about are not unique to the United States. I mean, this is our focus, but because of the book.
Hi, I'm Naomi. I think we also have to remember that the Egyptians enslaved the Jews for centuries, millennia ago, pre-Christianity. I tend to think this is apart from Christianity. I wonder, though, what makes... Let's take this person, the psychologist's hypothesis, and say that children are formed at such an early age. Well, how does one become a victim, and at what point do you become a victim and an oppressor? I'm kind of curious. These oppressors separate from the victims. And I somehow think that the victims are stronger, and in many cases, than the oppressors, because they don't have to overpower anybody else.
The victims are stronger.
More powerful. Because when you use force, when you have to use force, you're less powerful innately.
Well, in perhaps a more human, almost
yes,
existential way, certainly.
Yes.
But in actual, concrete, historical fact, that you know, when you think of the slave owners sort of sitting on the veranda, sipping their mint juleps, and everybody working for them, and people, of course...
They're forceful, but they're not really powerful, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I'm respectfully disagreeing in that, in terms of the concrete realities that people face in day-to-day living, and here we're just talking about the United States. Of course, these issues are worldwide, but in terms of who decides what the resources of life, how will the resources of life be distributed? Who will have the resources of life? Who will be able to raise children? Who will be able to breathe fresh air? All of the fundamental things that Zinn discusses. Who will be able to go to what school? Will I be able to have fresh water? Will I be able to sit next to you on a train? That some people decided that for other people. And in this country, it was white people of power deciding and getting other white people to do their dirty work for them. And as I mentioned, when black people have come to power, and if you look at the objective unfolding of U.S. history, even in more recent history than Reconstruction, in terms of some of the changes in the post-1960s of black mayors, and you look at African Americans as a group, by all the political criteria we have, there is no group in the United States that has fought more and has a better record at supporting political, social equality issues for the entire society than African Americans, part of which was, I guess, seared or forged out of that oppression, which people learned as victims. But when people have taken power, as I said, they have not, maybe that's the fear, when you talk about fear, going back to fear, that, wow, if these people get power, they're going to do to us what we've done to them. Well, that has not happened in U.S. history. In fact, that has not happened. But that may be the fear. And that also may be the strength you're talking about.
John, Zinn's comment in the chapter differentiated the Africans who captured other Africans to sell them to slave traders, as, you know, distinguished the slaves who did that enslavement and related them to serfdom, to European serfdom, not the kind of slavery that was instituted here. Can you discuss that in relation to tribalism?
Well, we do know, I mean, we have the historical records that, yes, there were some groups in Africa that aided the Portuguese and others in enslaving other black people. I mean, that's a historical fact. Not many. I mean, there have been the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire, in discussing how hierarchy develops, argues that there are oppressors and then sub-oppressors. I'm not sure how that fits with the issue of tribalism, even though we do know about tribalism, or let's say what I've been able to glean from the reading I've done, is, of course, when people were enslaved, that they were deliberately separated via different groups, linguistic groups, so that people, that it would make it more difficult, of course, for people to organize in rebellion. But I'm not sure, I don't have enough background to, if you're meaning there's a connection between tribalism and slavery, the connection is, it, I would argue, is, from what I've been able to understand, is, would seem to be very, very tenuous. I mean, it's not inherent to be in a tribe, let's say a group of people, a clan, a nation state, however we divide people. I think what Zinn's arguing is it is not inherent to that makeup that that people enslave another. It occurs out of particular social and historical conditions. While it is endemic to the human species in that it occurs, this is the discussion we had about violence, etc., while it is endemic across humanity in that some human beings have enslaved others, it is not inherent and hardwired in the human species.
I'd like to bring up two other things, and one of them is blame, and sort of like a scapegoat element of slavery. And the other thing is the fact that no one wants to be on the bottom, socially, economically. And so like the blame factor comes in, for example, where Hitler blamed the Jews for all the economic problems Germany had. And you'll see it in this country, because middle class and the rich, and even some of the poor, blame the people on welfare we're giving away, in spite of the fact that we have a budget, 47% of the budget goes to defense, we have a $409 billion budget, and welfare costs are not that great. They blame all the problems on the poor. Another thing is, a lot of poor people, just poor whites, for example, don't want to be on the bottom, socially, economically, and they can't accept it. So they will say, well, I may be on the bottom, but I'm better than the homosexual. I'm better than the black, whatever, the other race, whatever that is.
Well, Mary, I think Mary was getting to that, and we do have ample historical evidence of whites in the South. I mean, can you think of a poorer area in the United States than Appalachia? I mean, people could trace their roots to the Mayflower, okay? The biggest export for decades in Appalachia was people. An incredibly oppressed area, poverty struggles, unions and other workers in coal mines in Kentucky and Tennessee and Alabama, and yet, again, using poor whites, dividing poor whites from poor blacks because the whites were not black, no matter how poor they were. And every single time in U.S. history when blacks and whites have come together, as in the populist movement in the South, people in power have done everything they could to divide it and crush that because they know, and I guess this is a kind of fear, they do know that if, here, just thinking of the black-white dichotomy, okay, it's greater. Racism is, you know, you study the history of Chinese in this state, in the United States, and Japanese, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, especially in New York, in the East, Dominicans, whatever, the racism is incredible, that if all those people come together with Euro-Americans and people realize that, yeah, there are differences, but in terms of the fundamentals of life, for safety and raising kids and having clean water and air and all of these things, that people have far more in common than differences, then the people who run the society are gone in a week, okay? If my ex-brother-in-law, who was a Teamster, worked hard and really understood that, you know, it was his labor that was enriching other people, if he could get rid of racism that, I mean, used to take my breath away, And he allied with people like him. He's solidly middle class, good Teamsters contract, good pension, Coast Guard too. If he got together with others who were not white like him, it'd be all over. It'd be all over. And you have to divide people. And you have to divide gay people and straight people. You know, and there, as I said, there are real differences in life. But the real differences are not as important as the real commonalities that we share as human beings on an earth with the earth. And once we see that, then we'll somehow, but to go back to what Hartley said, somehow then how do we sort of expel the poison that we've all had to ingest? And we didn't choose to ingest that, going back to kids. We don't choose our families. We don't choose to be born in a family who, let's say, my father's in the Klan, I'm born in Mississippi or Alabama, or he's a northern racist, or my mother. We don't choose that. So somehow we learn the poison, and somehow we have to expel it. One final comment.
The final word here. I appreciate the dialogue. My name is Orrin. I'm visiting from Miami with my family. I have taught history in Miami for 30 years. And have had the benefit of having my wife is from Haiti, and she explained a lot of the problems that she's gone through in this country in moving as a young girl, 13 years old, to Boston, and having the struggle to learn the English language and adapt to a new culture and struggle with the racism here in America. I thought about this problem and everything everybody brought up I thought was very interesting. It's a very racism is a very complex problem to deal with economically, politically, psychologically, socially, tribally. But to bring things up to date, I was at the library the other day and I picked up a copy of LA Youth, which I understand was brought about as a result of censorship here in the schools, that the federal government said that the schools have the authority to censor what students write. And the students, there was an article about the gang fights in the schools here, as we have all over the country, but especially here and also in Miami between the races. And I noticed the Hispanic kids and the African-American kids, they write about things that the gang fights, the reasons why there's the hate and the violence against one another. And to me, it brings everything from Spartacus and the Roman slavery system up through chattel slavery here in America, Reconstruction, the struggle for black equality, up into contemporary conflicts here between the races. And one thing that I would like to see is a solution brought about by local and state and the federal government to the continuing violence and trying to bring about peace in the communities and in the schools. And as you brought up yourself, John, racism, we're not born that way, but it comes about where we accumulate it through the environment. We're taught it in various ways, and we pick it up from the people around us. I guess everybody has to take a look at their own prejudices, and everybody has them, unconscious or not. But thank you very much. I appreciate having the last word, too, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your visit. So, see you next month.
You have been listening to the question and answer session from Dr. John Marciano's June 21, 2005, discussion of Chapters 2 and 9 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. John's commentary is available in Part 1. Every month, a group led by Dr. Marciano meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of the decentralized democratic civic media.